Welcome back to the G&JB Show, episode number 8. Jacko, how's things?
Good, thanks, White Axe. How are you, mate?
Good, mate. Who have we got on today?
We got Kurt Vogel, the guru.
The guru.
How are we?
Good, mate.
Not too bad, mate. Not too bad.
Mate, a million questions. You've been working with the boxers, our boxers, for what, 9, 10 years maybe, about that?
Yeah, I think nearly a decade.
Nearly a decade. That's what intelligent people say.
Nearly 10 years.
Yeah, I don't know, not decade mates. Dickhead. It's closest to I. But look, anyway, Goo, introduce yourself. What have you done? Bit about you. Cool. Let's go.
It's a bit of a long story. We'll keep it short. I guess I'm a strength conditioning coach, sports scientist for the last 12 plus years or so. Worked with youth athletes to amateur, professional, Olympic, across 6 different nations or so. Worked across nearly, I think I've counted up to 27 different sports. But I guess it's not just about the experience as well. I've made sure I've kind of got the background education as well. So I've done my master's of exercise science. I've actually gone outside that as well to do my master's of business. And done a bunch of qualifications around that too. So making sure I'm highly qualified and having the right mentors around me. And it's probably the easiest way to sum it up.
Yeah, nice.
As long as that can be.
Give us a bit about your feedback, sort of where you grew up, where you went to school. I don't know, what did you do as a kid, sport, and how you actually evolved into being the guru?
Funnily enough, I actually started growing up in Aratula, if people know where Aratula is, a little country town, population of 200, so a little country town. And
two of those people, and the other bloke looks like you.
Yeah, and I'm a twin, so two of us left, and that took away essentially 1% of the population.
Yeah, for sure.
We moved to the sunny coast after 6 years because our parents wanted to give us better opportunities for education. And yep. Then dad struggled to find work, so we moved to Mackay. And then after Mackay, I moved to Brizzy and haven't left since, and that was for uni. And I guess over that time, dad brought us into rugby league a little bit.
Yep.
And grew up playing rugby league, representative level as well. And my brother's always been better than me at sport, so
yep.
It kills me.
What's he doing now?
He's a FIFA worker.
Is he?
Yeah. I can't
fly in, fly, fly out.
Yeah, fly
in the
in,
mines.
Fly
whereabouts?
Out
in the mines. You know, where's?
There's a mine down in New South Wales. He yeah. was in one of the mines that blew up.
Yeah, nice.
Up north. So, but he lives in Sydney.
Yeah.
And funnily enough, we're actually doing very similar things, as much as they're different industries, because we're both working with accelerometers.
Yeah.
I'm working with accelerometers in sports. He's working with accelerometers in mining. We had no idea until I asked him or told him about what I'm doing, and
yeah.
and he goes, "Oh, that's what I'm doing."
Yeah, right.
Yeah, no nice. Idea. So,
finally so he's going up in the. So he's working his way up too.
Yeah, yeah. He's done really well for himself
in
FIFA work. So
excellent.
Yeah, he's good, and he's just started his engineering degree.
Yeah, nice. So. Can I just jump in firstly? One question that I wanted to ask is. Mate, you worked with Luke Bateman for a number of years before he moved to Canberra Raiders.
Yeah.
Tell us what he was like as a young man coming through. What was the difference between him and some other kids that don't actually make any sport? Now he's stamped his mark and played first grade regularly now. So what is it? I want the people to know, what is the difference between somebody that makes it, you know, in the NRL, and somebody that is a Queensland couple will only stay there? What do you think that difference is?
There's quite a few things that you can kind of go over, and some people actually just get unlucky, or some people do get lucky. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's the biggest one in regards to luck, because before I talk about this in regards to the youth, you can actually just have one person get injured, and once that person gets injured, someone fills in, and they do so well that the injured person comes back, and then they get dropped because that other person that stepped up actually did better. So,
yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that was actually how Milford got a start at Canberra. He filled in for one injured,
yeah.
and then got reduced to bench after they came back, and then he made a run on straight up after that.
Right.
So, but in regards to, I guess, the youth athletes, it's basically having that that drive that you want to be there, and having that drive, that motivation to be there is all the difference, because if you can actually commit to your training sessions and work hard through those training sessions, then you'll actually get further than just having that raw talent behind you.
Yeah, 100%.
And I've seen a lot of kids that have that raw talent, and some have actually been dropped from squads that I've worked with because they won't actually turn up to training, or they think, I'm going to get picked anyway.
Yeah.
And they end up getting dropped. And after they get dropped, they don't get picked up anywhere else. And they have talent greater than some of the potential I've seen actually make it before.
Can I just jump on that for 1 second? Sometimes it's a detriment being great as a kid, because success comes easier to them with that natural ability. Well, those kids that have worked hard, like Luke Bateman, I know he used to see you with you in the gym all the time. He was doing his extras all the time. Always used to his form. You were always correcting his form and everything he was doing. I remember when he was at the gym next door, and obviously now he's got on to bigger and better things. But sometimes being a great kid is not a great pathway to be a great senior athlete. You know, because when it comes easy, you don't have that work ethic. Well, when you get to 19, 20, 21, the boys are big, they're harder, they're mature men, and they're trying to rip your head off no matter whatever sport it is. They're competing hard against you, and you haven't got that work ethic from being a young man. Well, that's really hard. I generally reckon the ones that aren't super successful as a kid are generally the ones that probably go on to bigger and better things, you know, because they've worked hard.
Yeah, and there's a couple of things around this too, because one of the biggest aspects around youth training at the moment is actually creating autonomy. And what that means is rather than just teaching them the strength work or taking them through conditioning work, we actually teach them to be autonomous as an athlete. So even if they're talented, they actually need to do the work before they get recognition. They need to do the work and actually achieve low levels before they can go up. So some talented kids could probably squat 60 kilos straight up.
Yeah.
But if they don't progress past the basic barbell with your technique, then you don't go up a weight.
Yeah.
So they learn to actually have to work for something. So sometimes, or like I said, nowadays, in this, we actually talk about creating that autonomy, particularly for those talented kids, because they try and get ahead of themselves.
Yeah.
And it sounds really bad. You're not trying to bring them down a peg or two, but what you're trying to do is teach those to kids not to get ahead of themselves, because you need to make sure you work for those rewards. It's not instant.
Yeah.
Nothing's going to come instantly. You need to be able to work to get those rewards, and you'll find those athletes that learn to be autonomous as a adolescent will tend to go on and achieve greater things.
Mm. Is that just breaking it down and breaking the skill back down to basics as well?
That's just one example of it. Yeah.
I guess like we've always done that too here in boxing, or Gareth will. Like I'd watch Damien Hooper and see some of the moves he would do, and then you just go straight into it. And like sometimes you'd pull it off.
Yeah.
Half the time you wouldn't.
Yeah.
And then he'd get us doing partner work drills where you'd have your hands up for the whole time. And I remember as a kid, I'd get so frustrated doing the boring stuff. Mm. But then eventually when you get to actually perform the skill properly. And
that's why I do it. That's
why I had to break it down, because.
Well, didn't you just say that the other day when you used to hate partner work? Now you know it's an avid part of training because you're working on one skill to perfect it over and over and over.
Yep.
And then you have a fight. Oh, it came off. Well, if you hadn't practiced, it wouldn't really come off. Or the chance of it coming off would be very slim, wouldn't they, if you hadn't practiced so much?
That was like the start of the year, how you said we need to work on more feints, adding our hook-offs more. And I think it was just doing your jab.
Mm.
A nice, effective jab, smart early. And then we broke it back down to doing that instead of, as you both have seen, I drop my hands in my fight sometimes, get silly. But then you lose the fights.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, most times. Most times.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, just breaking that skill back down. Yeah, I can see how that's important.
And that kind of thing in regards to skill development is really important, particularly with sparring work, when some people think, if you're in tennis, just hitting balls will work. But funnily enough, your mind works in a way that it actually wants to premeditate what's happening. So the first work started in cricket, where you know how they used to use the ball machines? But the cricketers weren't getting better. And they started testing reaction times, and they found that they could actually predict the shots before the ball had even left the hand a lot of the time. And that they couldn't figure out why, and they started looking at what's happening in the brain. And essentially, they were actually being able to determine what's going to happen without knowing it before they're actually moving. So doing the actual skill is really crucial in the actual sport itself as well. So you need to be able to learn the basics and then integrate it. So that, and that's why something like sparring is so important. So you can actually learn to read those skills. Whereas if you just do the basic skills by themselves, as much as they're important, you then need to integrate it. So it has those, that double level there.
I remember one time this is early days when we had like Paddy and all those guys training with us. And I remember you were saying too many boxing people worry about the punch. Well, and I remember you saying the punch actually travels both ways. It goes forwards and back. And too many strength experts, so to speak, I don't know however else to say them, always worry about the push action. Well, the pull action is as vital as doing both. Do you want to give us a bit of insight into that?
So if you actually look at punches, you've got obviously different techniques across the world. But when you actually throw a punch, you've got to look at what's pulling in the opposite direction. And if you actually, say, if you're punching with your lead and you actually try and focus on the pull, your hand's going to extend quicker than if you're just trying to punch forward. It's called force coupling, which basically means opposite muscles are working to do the same thing, which creates a stronger contraction, which a faster contraction. And a really simple one of that, or coordination-wise, is if you're driving a car and you're turning left, you've got one hand doing one thing, one hand doing the other. So using different musculature to do the same thing.
Just for everyone, Jacko's just going through this action. And he's driving a car. Was that a car, Jack? We're changing gears.
So when you actually, and you can actually try this at home, if you try and just throw one punch without pulling the opposite, opposite arm backwards, and then try and actually pull the arm first, you'll notice you'll extend the arm quicker, just out of reaction. So then there's obviously the balance around the shoulder joint. That's important too, to make sure the musculature is stable around the shoulder joint, but that's more than just pulling action. You've got a lot of stability around that shoulder joint because there's a ton of muscles around there. So, but in regards to speed, working out pull will actually enhance the punch. You could actually not work on the punching for a whole 4 weeks and just work on the pulling, and you'll have a faster punch.
Also, I just want to go into traditional boxing exercises, old school, and where a lot of people still have not developed with the times. They're still doing the same things. I know, you know, everybody seems to have a strength and conditioner this day, this day and age. But you've got to be really specific in what you're trying to do if you're going to improve. Otherwise, you'll just, I suppose, you'll just become general. You know, you'll just improve the general strength, or if you're doing it wrong, you will create injuries. So, like, I suppose if you think about all the boxers you've worked with, a base, what is one area that they need to improve? Because I'm going off track here. I'm trying to say is, everybody does sit-ups. They think 1,000 sit-ups is what you do. Well, we know nowadays core strength is it's involved all around. It wraps around your whole body, does the core. But too many people still think core strength is ab work, which is totally a different muscle, isn't it? Can you give us a bit more of insight into core strength and how that can improve and why it's and actually what it is? Because I think a lot of people in our boxing world, and, you know, it took – I didn't learn this until we met you. Like, you know, you think you just do 500 abs a day. You know, so can you give us a bit of insight into the core and why it's so important for, well, sport, I suppose, in general, instead of boxing, is it?
And you can actually look at the word core in regards to just saying it's stability around a joint. But when we look at the torso and the and referring to the core in regards to our hips and our torso, there are, just to stabilize the hip, I think it's 26 different muscles. So if you're just focusing on
this guy is a strength nerd.
So
really, 26 different muscles
around just around the hip and the torso there. So when you're looking at enhancing as a boxer, you've got to look at bracing movements, rotation movements, anti-rotation movements, I guess movement through the different planes, so I lateral movements, forward and backwards, and I guess multi-directional. So you're not just staying in linear planes, so that means just really strict planes, you're going on angles as well. So you've got so many different capacities to enhance your core as a boxer, but the one big thing is to not get carried away, just changing all the time.
Yeah, right.
So you've got to be able to build on each of those. So as an example, if no one's heard of the Parlov press is a good way to start. It's an anti-rotation movement.
That's with the elastic band, isn't
it? To the side.
Pull to the, yeah, right.
Yeah, yep, and you actually press out. It's an anti-rotation movement. So you're actually bracing the core in that movement to stop rotation. And then you can add speed to that. You can add a step to that. But you're still bracing and just changing the movement slightly.
Yeah.
And then you can add rotation and multi-directions and all these kind of things. So, but just not to get carried away with one thing each week. And that's the hardest thing. Most people nowadays see everything on Instagram and go, I'll try that.
Chop and change.
But there's reasons behind it. Yeah. Remember, Instagram is only clips showing the best exciting bits.
Yeah.
People don't show their shit times or the basic work they have to do because it's boring. Yeah. You know what
exactly.
I mean?
Exactly.
But it has to be done like you said before.
Yeah. And I think the thing you need to remember is it's you want to train the adaptation of the muscle.
Mm.
You don't just want to train what's happening because anybody can kind of train a movement, but you want to train the physiological adaptation. So what is happening? What are you actually building in the structure of the body?
Yeah. Yeah, nice. Jacko.
So working with boxers for the past, 10 years, you said, what have you noticed that boxing athletes maybe show that might be a bit different to other athletes you've worked with? I know we suck a lot.
Yeah.
Or is that just me? Or?
I suppose every athlete has different strengths, and your ballet dancers, for such, so that would probably be one of the ultimate athletes that you've worked with, I would thought.
Yeah, so actually, you can draw similarities between boxers and ballet athletes in regards.
They wear
to
similar outfits. Oh, sorry.
Is that my flexibility?
Yeah.
is there a composure? So you can look at footy field and. I mean, look at all these other sports, and some athletes will hold their composure under their stress and when they're really struggling. But you can generally tell when someone's starting to slow down or fatigue. And the one thing I can draw parallels with between boxing and ballet is you're still reaching your max, but either one, you're still smiling, or you're actually not showing that you're actually hurting. And that's one thing I've really found with boxers is you can be hurting as much as you want, but you tend to not show it because there's other things you're focusing on.
Yeah.
Whereas sometimes in some of the team sport athletes I work with, your hands are on your knees or something like that, or you start to lean back to take a breather and someone points that out and suddenly you're targeted. Even in individual sports, you can see someone just take one slow step back and bang, you've nailed it. But a lot of times the boxers that I deal with, you can see them, like Jack's horrible for it. He'll just be, just take a rest. They'll stay composed, and that's probably one of the biggest things.
The strengths, I suppose.
Yeah.
Even in that Losers Netflix documentary, he says that, I forgot the guy's name.
Again. Michael Bent.
Yeah, he spoke about boxers are just so good at masking pain and what they're feeling and what they're going through.
Yeah.
Because you can't show that sign of weakness, especially in the ring, because people pick up on it. Especially when if you're fighting experienced boys, they pick up on the littlest.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But I've spoke to you about some fights I've had. And you see maybe something happens to someone.
Yeah.
And you can just see in their eyes or see a little movement or a look, to, the
momentum
look to their
swing,
corner or look to their parents in the crowd and you're like, well, I got you now. Yeah. And I think that's a really good point to touch on.
Yeah. And I'll add one more, which is it's probably with boxing athletes. I'll say I guess sports that are heaped in tradition more than some others is not knowing when to slow down. Because a lot of boxers will just, they've got the mentality to work, but you got to learn to listen to your body.
Mm.
And you do get some athletes in other sports like that, but you got to learn to go, okay, I'm really feeling tired today.
Yeah.
Just ease that session up
rather
than just going, I need to push harder. And at times we definitely need to push harder, but there's times you need to just listen and just
I agree.
Well, we had Todd Kidd on the podcast 2 weeks ago and he spoke about that, Kurt. just, I think he did a grip strength test or something when grip the boxes strength come he did in.
When they, yeah.
And just knowing when you're fatigued and mm-hmm. and when to work and when not.
Yeah.
To.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I guess you'd pick up on that a lot better. You'd know the signs and see signs as well.
And then most coaches will be able to once they've had a little bit of experience in the area.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see, apart from talking to an athlete, they'll tell you they're good, even if they feel great. And if you notice they're moving the bar a bit slower or running a bit slower, you go, we're just going to ease a session up here.
Yeah.
They go, oh, I'm feeling good, but you're not moving very well.
Yeah.
And sometimes they say they feel like rubbish and they're moving really well, moving real fast. You go, we're going to push you today.
Mm.
So you can actually notice it just from sometimes how they're moving.
Yeah. Mm. Well, I think that's happened with Jack actually a couple of weeks ago, like before States, he was feeling a bit flat. But then, you know, it was like, you know it's the time when to push them through. Like you said, when you've had experience with an athlete for a while, you get to understand their body language a little bit more, don't you? You know,
yeah.
He was a bit flat. I said, no, we've got to get through this, mate. We've got to do it. And he was really good. Sometimes, but where other times you go, oh, he's coming. He's, oh, I'm okay. And it's time to say, you know what? Have an early one tonight, mate. Yeah. Or let's go do some stretching or let's change the training, have a bit of, and sometimes, you know, go for a swim or just stay active if you have to. But
come to think of that.
Just variation.
Can I have the night off tonight?
No. The answer's no.
It's all well and good saying it, Gareth. You've got to back it up, mate.
Yeah, well, I'm reading your body language right now.
Yeah.
No.
So, he's moving pretty fast around the microphone.
Yeah.
Another thing I wanted to touch on, we spoke about the Anthony Joshua fight the other week, and a lot of the comments and backlash about Joshua's performance was people saying that he does, like, because he puts up a lot of strength and conditioning workouts, and you probably would have seen him. And people are saying he's too big and has too much muscle mass on him to perform, and he looks slow in the ring and fatigued.
And again,
like, they blame the muscle mass. I don't know the ins and outs of that, but boxing traditionalists like me and Gareth would be like, yeah, he looks too big. I just wanted to get your take on that. And we see people even – well, Joshua, for example, doesn't have to make weight, but we see people that maybe might look like they've got too much muscle mass, and does that affect their performance? Or I'll let you take over. But
and saying that, he is boxing 12 three-minute rounds as well. Yeah. He's not boxing three three-minute rounds, so I suppose everyone's different, but
Yeah, it doesn't actually do too much in regards to a negative, depending on – it more so depends on the actual S&C program. So they can actually have as much muscle as Anthony Joshua and still box fast and be as fit as they need to be.
Yeah.
But something could go wrong with S&C program where he has focused on something more than something else.
Okay.
That could lead to that – looking slow or feeling slow in the ring, even though his muscle mass may actually be the same, and sometimes it could be subconscious going, he's moving slow, he's looking a bit too big, but he might actually be the same size even if you don't think about it. So muscle mass isn't necessarily a stopper in that. You've technically got greater potentiation for speed, power, but it can eventually, if you look at mass in total, slow you down in regards to fatigue if you haven't focused on the fitness side of things too much.
Right.
So it just means there's a change.
So what they look like doesn't really mean much.
No. Yeah, okay. It just means something in the S&C program, if they are looking slow, hasn't gone the way it's meant to be.
Yeah.
They focus on something too much than another thing, and they might have just read their weaknesses wrong or their strengths incorrectly or felt, we're going to focus on this for this fella, and then someone's dropped out.
So it's not like –
that's actually what happened.
Yeah.
Miller. He got pulled out.
Yeah.
He failed a drug test.
Yeah. So by, you know, the untrained eye people, or Joshua looks really big, or he must be slow, that's not necessarily the case. And obviously, let's be honest.
Well, I thought that.
Anthony Joshua has got one of the best strength and conditioning outfits in the world around him. He trains at Team GB with exercise scientists and physiologists and everything. So they would leave no stone unturned. If we go back to Joshua, I think it was a mental something. I think his mind just was not working.
I watched a Fury interview,
you know,
and he was saying how he thought Ruiz was going to go the distance, and then when he saw AJ walk out, he was like, "No, he's going to lose."
His mindset looked different.
His mindset must have been mental. Yeah.
So
I guess you would have learned a lot about the mental side of, like, as a coach and how to motivate people.
Yeah.
Do you want to go into any any tips you've learned along the way, trying to motivate people, or like as far as the coaching side of it?
It's a pretty hard one because it's person by person. And funnily enough, I've the more work I do now tends to be in actually modifying or helping modify behavior and motivation rather than programming half the time. And it all comes down to what that person needs to focus on, I guess, if they're happy, for one, what they're happy doing. And that's trying to get to the key there is why are they doing the sport, what is making them happy, how do we manipulate this to make it good for them. And, and fun enough, I've learned a ton just from actually working with kids because of it. And anyone that's a parent or works with kids understands that you've got kids on a Friday afternoon, 10 of them together, and do you think they want to do a fitness session? So how are you going to even get that from a kid? And then now you've got to transfer that to an adult. So an adult would just think they're going to push past, but are you going to get everything from them? So pretty much it's figuring out what's going to engage them, and that's person-by-person basis. And something like someone like you, Jack, your engagement and reasons for doing things are going to be different to Gareth.
Yeah.
So it's just getting to know the person and asking them a few questions. And once they find out what you find out is engaging for them, becomes your tool to actually help them become motivated.
Yeah, right.
A few beers for you after it, Gareth.
See, that's my training.
Yeah.
That's my training. Yeah. And Kurt's going that way now too. So, so what other – you've worked with ballet dancers, you've worked with rowers, rugby league, rugby union as well?
Yeah.
Rugby union. What other sports that I haven't thrown in there? Rowing. I know you did rowing. Weightlifting.
Weightlifting, tennis, athletics, wheelchair basketball. Fencing.
How was wheelchair basketball? Let's talk about that. I've got a mate of mine that I used to play rugby league with.
Another drop again for rugby league. Who I played for.
I feel most S&C coaches start out in rugby league.
Yeah. So the a friend of mine. Oh, we're still going. I thought we'd turn off there for a sec. A friend of mine had an unfortunate accident. Many years ago when we were playing, he was playing in the Colts, Cameron Carr, but now you fast forward his life, he's won 2 Paralympic medals in wheelchair rugby. And I just threw his name in there because I knew. From training an able-bodied athlete to training somebody in a wheelchair, that had to be really challenging for you, I'm saying, if you've worked with Paralympics?
Well, when I first kind of got involved with it, I actually – did some experience at NSWIS down in Sydney, and one of the guys down there, Steve Adams, so he's a really good coach. He's a master coach under Asker, and I asked him a few questions. I said, oh, well, I guess I need to get my head around working with, I guess, these wheelchair athletes. He goes, why? I go, oh, how, like, you got to train for them differently. He goes, no, you don't. I just use the same rugby drills that I do for these guys.
Really?
But they're just in a wheelchair. Like, sorry, how? And he goes, markers out to these distances, get them to sprint, and they know how to sprint.
Yeah.
So you condition them the same way. It's just you need to know.
But that strength would be different, wouldn't it, the strength training?
A little bit. Depends what level they're at. So you've got different levels in regards to if their disability is, I guess, from the thoracic or from the lumbar, so you have different levels. And I've been fortunate enough, funnily enough, one of the girls I've helped work with, who's a good friend of mine now, she's actually coming over to Brizzy for a comp tomorrow. So I'll go watch her at Karina.
I'm playing with basketball.
Yeah. So, but sometimes you've got to look at the disability. Like I said, that person, she has clubfoot, so she can actually get out of the wheelchair and walk. Whereas with other people, which are actually bound to the wheelchair they've worked with, so you've got different positions. And sometimes, so say this person, Amber, she can get out of the wheelchair. So instead of actually doing something just for a sport specifically, we try to just build her confidence. So she has very limited ability to squat properly. So we built her confidence by being able to get her to squat deep. Yeah, is it going to be relevant for the sport? No. But is it relevant for her confidence? Yes.
Yeah, wow.
And that point... Yeah, she did so well in regards to building her strength from there as well. And
nice.
The guys at Wace in Perth do a really good job looking after at the moment. But, yeah, so it's just You got to look at that as well.
Yeah, true. I suppose what are they classed as? Wheelchair athlete, I suppose. Wheelchair athlete is an individual as well. Their disability is in a different spot. So when we talked about core strength, well, wow, that's totally. It'd be irrelevant in some wheelchair athletes.
It'd be total
upper body and exercises, I suppose. Yeah,
sometimes it can be.
Yeah.
If you look at them the same way as I would look at, say, comparing Lockett to Jack, you just need to know what the weaknesses are because you just train them exactly the same. And people think that's a bit strange, but they perform the same as anywhere else. There's nothing wrong with their motivation, their mentality behind their training, because they want to be an athlete. And so you just train them the same way.
Everyone's an individual, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Even in a team sport. And that has to be recognized. I think the greatest team coaches or the coaches of teams realize that everybody's an individual and they are a very important part to make that team up, you know?
Absolutely. And so the wheelchair athletes, they're not disabled athletes, they're athletes.
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to come back a little bit back to boxing and traditional training methods.
Yep.
I know you and Gareth might get into a little bit of a blow over this, so I'll bring it up and I might sit back. But just in regards to track work, speed work with running and whatnot, I just want to get your take on what you would recommend boxers do on the track and how that steers away from maybe traditional track work.
Yep. So,
and Gareth, I want you to fire up a little.
Oi, traditional track work didn't used to exist. It was just fucking run 20Ks every day, you know. Yeah. But
that's totally true.
So I might be ahead of the game, but I'm not in guru's fucking world. I know that.
You haven't steered me wrong yet.
We've all got our weaknesses and our strengths.
I've got strengths and stronger strengths, not weaknesses.
There's your weakness there.
Yeah, there you go. Can't admit it.
I think you kind of also have to look at training age a little. So if you look at training age, as much as, say, speed work is important, track work can be important, does the athlete actually have a base to begin with? And my philosophy sits into, if you train slow, you fight slow or you play slow.
Yeah,
so
slow,
now, as much as you've got to build that physical capacity, and like we mentioned before, training the physical adaptation, sometimes track work can be too slow. So if you're looking at 1200s or 1600s, they're nearly like the same, as a little bit faster, but going for like a 5K or 3K run with a slightly higher intensity. But you can nearly get the same out of that by doing short work fast with a short rest. So say, for example, you might do 100s on the minute going and build up from 20 to 50, and then you've got 5K of doing 100s under a certain speed. Whereas if you're doing, say, 6 1200s or 6 1Ks or something, you're still much slower than any of those 100s.
Yeah.
So you're then staying fast.
Yeah.
And you can do the same thing with a ball against the wall as well. There is some level of importance in traditional track work, but linear track work, going, okay, 1600s this week, 2 weeks later, 1200s next two weeks, 800s and 400s, 200s and 100s.
We haven't done
1600s,
so don't get any idea.
I like that
Google talk. so they can work because you're still getting a physical adaptation, but you have to look at what is the adaptation, and does the boxer or can the boxer still push off fast off the mat? And we found sometimes that if you're just doing track work and just doing your runs, then you're still a little bit slow off that first mark.
Yeah.
So 20-meter sprints will work a lot better than, say, 800s. If you do 20-meter sprint, wait 5 seconds, 20-meter sprint, wait 5 seconds, do that over a three-minute block.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard, but you're going to be faster than any 800 runner, or 800 run, sorry. And then you rest a couple minutes, then do the same thing again. You're still getting that bang off the mark, bang off the mark, bang off the mark, over and over and over.
And is that like that transfer into boxing, as far as you've got to be quick off the mark all the time?
Exactly, that quick step. So, but like I said, different parts of training can be good for different things. Yeah. So it depends on the training age of the athlete as well. If they're coming into a program or if they've been in a program for a few years. So what have you got to really work on, and what have you actually got to build in their capacity as well?
Mm-hmm. I've noticed sometimes, in the past, sometimes we think we've done it right, and then when I say we, I say myself. Yep. And then I shorten the sprints down to 20s or 40s, there's pain in the boys' glutes and hammies for a few days, and I'm thinking, oh shit, should I start it a few weeks earlier? How do you know when to start that sharp base of sprints? Or again, is it individual athlete? Everyone's different.
So this comes down to injury methodology, and what they've kind of found out over the last few years is, if you're doing sprint work needs to be maintained weekly, minimum. So they'll get those really sore hammies and glutes because they haven't done that speed work. So to actually
that happened to me.
You've got to expose the body to speed work constantly to not get sore or not get injuries from speed work.
Yeah.
So that's why sometimes track work can be a negative as well. If you did say one sprint session a week, is better than, I know, I mean short distance sprint is better than no sprint session a week, because eventually you're going to then do some extra sprint work.
So say you've come off a four-week break, which is rare. Yeah. They have a four-week break, but just saying that, they have a four-week break, I'm guessing you wouldn't start sprinting week one.
What you can do is actually do sprints at 80%. You don't always have to work at that 100% level. So even an 800, that might be 100%, but a slower pace.
Yeah.
But you might actually go, we're going to start at 100s, and you're going to be running at 19 seconds for the 100 for this block.
Yeah, right.
And then next week you're going to do your 100s again, but you're going to be running at the 17 seconds. Yeah. And by third week, and I usually give a two-week lead-in.
11 seconds.
that's a big jump, Gareth. I'm glad you can still run that fast. Saying,
yeah, still got it.
So, particularly with your height.
Here we go.
Fucking hell.
That's why I go to the boxing game.
But I guess that'd come, like when we do a training block, like for say a states or a nationals, and I know the track work we pretty much do inside out. So I know if I'm hitting like certain times or like I'm fit, as opposed to doing say like bike sessions, and I might be getting the same like output and getting the same fitness work, but I don't feel like I'm fit, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Unless like, you know you're hitting
your
times.
We spoke about it earlier in the year, and I was like, I just don't think I'm fit.
Yeah.
But when we do track work, and we went on the track and I hit all the times.
Yeah.
And it was unreal. But I just, I struggle. I guess if we did a whole program of doing the sprints work and hitting, say, the 100 zone, the 19 sections, and having the rest, then I'd start to get to know the program.
Better. Yeah.
But,
Yeah, excellent. Hey, Goo. There's a question somebody asked me this morning, right? Mate, and I've got no idea what this is, right? So I'm going to put a few words in. What the fuck does force velocity curve manipulation? I can't even say it. Force velocity curve manipulation mean? What is it? One of the boys at the gym this morning, we did a strength program. He's been looking all over your LinkedIn, so he's a bit of a stalker. He goes, mate, get this guy to explain this. I said, well, I'm fucking out. I've got no idea what he's talking about.
So there's basically a graph. So if you you can picture a graph, on one side of the graph is called velocity, and the other side of the graph is called force. Now, there's a curve which starts, let's just say, at zero, if force is the bottom.
Yep.
So it starts at zero. If that's zero, then your velocity is just say at 100. And we use percentages, we'll just say percent, right?
Yep.
Now, when that velocity starts to go down, it means the force is getting higher. So that way it's a depreciating curve, which means more force, less velocity. So the manipulation comes down to going, okay, what are we going to do? Are we going to focus on increasing the force and trying to maintain velocity? We're going to try and increase velocity and reduce force slightly. And you've got to try and shift that curve in a graph. And I can actually give the graph to Gareth, and he can post it on Insta so people know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I'll do that,
And the key to boxing is being able to manipulate that curve together rather than just manipulating force and the velocity.
Yeah, one or the other.
You want to be able to manipulate the whole curve. And the thing I find a lot of times with people training boxers is they either focus on there's a section in the power area, which is around 30% of force,
yeah,
which is considered the greatest power output pending the exercise.
Yeah.
And people focus on that too much. You can have a great power, but you're still lacking a little bit of speed or a little bit of force. And now power is a derivative of force velocity. That means force times velocity equals power. So
I'm not going to lie.
Yep.
That went all over my head.
I'm going to listen back to this and I might get
but
it.
But when I get time. Exercises, I just trust.
Basically, yeah. Yeah, trust if, you, that he knows what he's if doing. You multiply one side of the graph to the other side of the graph, that equals your power.
Okay.
Well, so you can actually
I don't have much of that anyway.
You can actually have a high level of power,
yeah,
but it doesn't mean you're going to have a greater impact on your punch.
Yeah, right.
Because you may not be fast enough to connect and they might pull away enough. So you've got to look at
now
where
makes,
the,
now makes sense.
Where yeah. the what's called impulse is, not the power. It's two different things, and they're physics terms. I'm not going to go into that. So, yeah.
No, because we don't.
You can look up physics. Impulse compared to
power. Well, you can have lots of power, but can you hit him if he dodges it?
Yeah, yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly. So
you've got to break it down. I'm only a simple boy, Kurt.
And sometimes you can see some of your athletes have that. They have this big, powerful punch, but they're actually loading up their punch to get that power in, and you will – you're not actually fast enough to get that in. So it's boxing. Boxing is a tricky one, and I like that about boxing.
Yeah.
I suppose what I want to ask, if you had a new athlete and you had him from a childhood, a boxing athlete, we only train our kids 3 days a week because some of them only train two.
Mm.
Katie and Eddie, they only train two. They play netball and do other things. I think that is vital. I don't think you're training kids 5 days a week, make them do extra runs all the time. Mate, you know what? You generally don't see those guys as adults, as elite athletes, you know what I mean, as seniors.
Yeah.
If you had an athlete, say you want to be a boxer, as a junior, say a 10-year-old, starting out, what, and you knew you had them for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know how long we've got them.
Yeah.
Or 12 years. They wanted to get the Olympics in 12 years. What would you do as a child? Take boxing skills out of it. Mm-hmm. What would you concentrate on? Would it be more fun-based agility, acrobatics, gymnastics style, and a little bit of boxing? Or what do you think you'd concentrate on if you had a junior that was going to make it? So you just had to mold it to make that Olympic Games.
This sounds really broad. Ask a kid what they enjoy.
Yeah.
Because if you get them to enjoy what they're going to do, then they'll stay with you for the 10 years. And if they go, oh, you know what? I really like netball. You go, well, go and have some fun at netball and we'll come and do some other skills here.
Yeah.
So if you've got them, then we'd probably focus on some body weight stuff, a few games and building capacity
for
that.
They like that. Yeah,
exactly.
That sort of stuff,
and that builds not just engagement but coordination.
Yeah.
So you look at it's not just building the physical realm here, it's building the mental.
Yeah.
And if you can keep them
and
engaged,
it's overlooked sometimes. It's really overlooked sometimes.
Particularly coordination.
You can't see it, you know.
And kids that play, this is contentious, I guess controversial, because some people say, oh, you can be a specialist athlete and do really well. Look at China. But then you look at multi-sport athletes and they do really well later on as well. But I think that gets a little bit lost at times because they think it's either one or the other.
Mm.
Like you just, as long as the junior is having fun and they're enjoying what they're doing, and you're still providing an environment that challenges them, then they're going to be with you for the 10 years.
So, I think it's a tough one because a lot of people I use boxing because it's what we do, but I think it'd be in all sports they think, oh, I've got the next superstar, you know? So they drill them. You know what? By the time they're 17, it's, fuck you, I don't want to do this anymore. Yeah, you know, they're just over it mentally and you can't see. No, let's keep going. Well, if you're the one forcing them to do it, you ain't going to get the best out of them anyway. They have got to love it and want to do it.
Absolutely. And then the amount of 15-year-old swimmers that I've known quit the
swimming's
sport.
A big one.
And they've beat Olympic athletes now.
Yeah.
Like, they beat them and they quit the sport because once they get out of school, they go, no way in hell.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do that again. That's too mentally draining.
Well,
they just can't
that
do
would
it.
Be a draining sport, so, though.
Yeah. Well, I remember talking to Michael Boll when, he's trained Olympians and Commonwealth Games and World Championship swimmers. He told me his daughter, Georgia, she didn't start training 3 days a week until she was 16 years old.
Yeah.
Where other kids, and now she just went to the Olympics.
Yeah.
Did she go to Olympics or Commonwealth Games? Anyway, she's at that top level now. She's Australian level and doing great things. But, you know, some other swimming coaches I know, they've got them morning and night in the pool from 11 years old.
Yeah, exactly.
I actually worked with other swimmers as well. I won't mention any names, but this girl, she'd come and do boxing for their cross training, and she could not lift her hands above her waist. That was told by the physios and the doctors.
Yeah.
Don't lift your hands above your waist unless you are actually swimming. Because her shoulders were that done, because she got drilled from an early age, rolling the arms over. Just, I'm guessing it's tendonitis, and you might know a bit more than me.
So the more you move a joint in a specific position, the looser it gets over time, depending on what you're doing with it. Luke Bateman's a good example. Yeah. He was actually a state swimmer.
Oh, was he a swimmer?
Butterfly specialist, so you could understand what movement he goes through. We didn't do a lot of bench press with Luke because of his shoulders. And we had to do a lot of work on stabilizing the shoulders, did a lot of overhead work, did a lot of stability work, and build the strength around it before we could actually do bench press. So I don't think we actually did anything over 100 kilos when I dealt with him. But his shoulders are now stable, which is great. And now I think what does bench is 130, 140.
Well, he's kicking big goals now, doing excellent, isn't he?
Yeah, well, we've never really done over 100 kilos either.
I doubt it's
the same reasons.
There's a story about Gareth, actually.
Can we get on to that?
We've got another 15 minutes.
So we're doing testing a couple of years ago with the boxers, and we're actually doing some bench press testing.
No, I was there that day.
That's you as well.
Yeah.
And we're doing some close grip bench testing, and and all the boxers getting in on this. We had some people that hit 60, 80, 75. And then we got G over, Gareth over, no warm up.
Big man.
Boom, 115.
Oh, yeah,
man.
Was it 115 or was it
100?
It was 115.
Yeah, because 100 is like my warm up.
When was the last time you did bench before that, Gareth?
It was fucking probably. Look, at least 8 months, but not even solid. It was probably doing again like that a couple of goes, you know.
So something you do have a tendency
to do that. I remember we went.
I'm good for one. I can't back up. So I'm sore for 3 fucking months.
Atom opened up Ace Sports Medicine down the road, was it? Yeah, and we had a free Pilates session, and Gareth was doing handstands. Yeah. Doing a few other tricks.
What about wall dancing?
And I heard you couldn't walk for a few days after.
Don't even worry about it. Who knows?
It's about how you perform in the day.
Well, I pushed on, but I never made another session.
Doesn't matter. Stephen Bradbury won the Olympic gold medal in one performance. He didn't have to back it up the next day. Doesn't matter, mate.
He wasn't 55 either.
So
mate, what
gymnastics
about
has a good background.
Gymnastics has a good background, mate. That's when I asked you about if you had a junior, at the time, it was hard. You know, gymnastics is a hard upbringing because your body grows and stiffens up and tightens up, you know, and it does. But were they the right words?
How old are you now?
I don't think I'm 27. 50s?
I'd say even with gymnastics, it is a hard upbringing. Sorry to interrupt. Yep. Is that it's making sure that, again, like you said before, that as a kid, they're not doing too much of it.
That's right, yeah, exactly.
If they want to go into gymnastics, then you're going to kind of stick to their program.
But that's right.
As a basic foundation, not doing too much of it is awesome.
That's right. The thing is, though, unfortunately, with gymnastics, you have to keep your flexibility up.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Even at that young age. But look, and then you're competing with the Russians and the Chinese who are like,
do you want to do a handstand now, Gareth?
Yeah. No. I've got a fat guy. Oh, we haven't got the video on, so I'm right. I think, like I said, if I had that junior athlete that I knew was going to make the Olympics, I just had to fill the gaps in.
Yeah.
I think, you know, like you said, interpret play in their warm-ups or whatever it is they're doing. Add some gymnastics exercise, some holding position. I know you did a bit of gymnastic work with some of your training that you've done.
I've got the boxers to do some ballet work too. I enjoyed that.
I remember you got us to do handstands one day and I was flat out doing a handstand.
Yeah, Did you do it on two hands or one?
No, two. Good question.
Yeah. We have done some interesting exercises, but I've just been like, mate, this is not going to happen.
Some balance.
What about when you were spinning around with a stick on your finger or something like that?
I was all right with that. Yeah. There was one just you like made us drunk. Do sit-ups on the bag, and I remember fell down the bag because my legs were all sweaty. It. Yeah, and no, you didn't grab me. You weren't there helping me.
Let me go.
I smashed my neck on the floor, and
I was thinking Mitch smashed himself too.
Mitch,
didn't he fall off a treadmill too?
Yeah.
That was an excellent day. go at them doing 20-20s on the treadmill.
Yeah, and the one thing you've got to learn as a coach is you make mistakes, and this is when Mitch fell off the treadmill, because I thought Mitch had come in with the treadmill sessions with me before. And I said to Mitch, you know what you're doing on the treadmill, Mitch? He goes, yep, I know.
Yeah.
And so I give him the session, and basically jumping on off the treadmill, which means when you hold the side of the treadmill, you jump back on, you take a little bit of pressure, gradually take more pressure and start sprinting within 1 second.
The belt's still going, exactly, isn't it? Even when you're off. The
belt's still going. And Mitch had put his hands on the side and just full weight off straight away. Boom, 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 boom. And
he's just shot into the back wall.
Off the back of the treadmill. He's grazed the center of his nose, elbow. Oh, it's one of those things. Mitch, what are you doing? Because I've never done this before. I said, you just said you knew what you're doing. So, I mean, as coaches, we all make mistakes as well. And, I mean, as much as you can laugh at, like, obviously, it could have
been an
injury.
That's a good mistake.
Because by the time I got to do the session, I was fine. I didn't feel
like. As I've told you for a long time, learn from other people's mistakes, not your own. All right, excellent. Any more, Jacko?
No, that was pretty much covered everything, Kurt. Really appreciate you coming down and talking to us and sharing some of your knowledge to the people that listen to our podcast.
We're getting a lot of people listening, and you know, it's friends, family, obviously that's how it started, but people in boxing and, you know,
I think
other
this
sports,
is important
for
our, like, the education in our community specifically, because people just, like, as you said, they see something on Instagram, oh, we'll just do that this week.
Yeah.
And that might not be beneficial for the boxer.
And I'm happy to answer any follow-on questions after as well. Just hit me up on Instagram or
give them your Instagram or your website handles. Let everybody know. Good. Tell them what they are.
Instagram is Kurt Vogel _ coach. So Gareth will tag that for everyone. Yep. So that's probably the easiest way to just click me a message or rather than
do you get back to emails or
sometimes I need to be a bit quicker on emails. Yeah. So I'm probably quicker on message or Instagram.
Yeah, Instagram's the best way to do it.
But yeah, if you want to know more, contact Kurt. He'll be happy to help anybody out. And I suppose, look, we wrap it up. You know, if you're a coach, if your expertise is boxing or rugby league or footy or boxing or whatever, I don't know, or ballet or whatever it is, and then you can get an expert in your strength and conditioning area, it's probably best to do it. That's probably wrap it up rather than trying to cover everything. It's just too hard. Nobody can do everything, you know?
Exactly, and that's why people specialize a lot. Like, I've worked across a lot of sports because I work, specifically try and work in development athletes, which means you need a bit of a broad kind of exposure.
Yeah.
But if you're a coach trying to do everything, then it means you're falling short on something.
Yeah, that's right. You do. And look, we all do that. We all do that at times, you know.
And I think the biggest thing is, as soon as you get out, say, of a coaching course, or you've done something really good in coaching, you have this 100% confidence of, I know everything.
Yeah.
And then about 2 months later, you're brought back down to, oh God, I know nothing.
Shit, what happened there? Yeah,
and
exactly.
You've gone from
expert
level to nothing. And so the more you think you know, then the less you know.
Yeah, great.
So,
All
right.
A big one for boxing.
Excellent. Yeah, that's right. All right. Thanks Guru. The Guru. Hit him up. KurtVogel.com, is it? Or .com.au?
KurtVogel.net.
.net. Oh, my God.
Thanks again, Kurt.
Thank you very much. Thanks, guys.